Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, the presidential race is in its final stretch, and both President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden are laser focused on Florida. No surprise, Tom, especially this state's large Latino vote.
Yeah, new polling comes in almost every day, it seems like, and obviously a very tight race statewide here in Florida, including among Latino voters. Now, it's a diverse and critical voting bloc for the candidates that could swing this election in what has been less than a 1% state for a number of presidential election years. President Trump leads among likely Cuban-American voters in South Florida. That's a traditional source of support for Republicans. Several voter surveys have found former Vice President Biden leading among registered Hispanic voters statewide, but by less of a margin than Hillary Clinton had in the election 4 years ago.
That's right. So Cuban-American voters in South Florida, voters in Colombian, Venezuelan, El Salvadoran, Central American communities around the state, Puerto Rican voters concentrated in Central Florida, lots of groups of voters. We're going to begin the hour here on the Florida Roundup talking about the battle for this complex and diverse Hispanic vote in Florida. What's happening right now in the state to reach these voters? And we want to know, give us a call wherever you are around the state. Who will get your vote this fall and why? The number to join the Florida Roundup anywhere in Florida right now is 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. We're pleased to welcome Jodnisi Velez, Florida Director with the Hispanic Federation, on the line. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you on the show. So you've been involved in increasing Latino voter registration in Florida. How do you assess these two campaigns, the Trump campaign and the Biden campaign, in their efforts to reach out to voters across the state?
Well, first of all, we are a nonpartisan organization, and everything that we have been doing has been from that standpoint. But it is interesting, as you beginning to discuss, our Latino community is not a monolithic block of voters. It's a very diverse in cultures, very different between faith and politic values. And we know that is to be true that each campaign needs to make amendments with the Latino community in terms of how they're considered their voice, our voice, as part of their issue-based platform. And part of that is how they approach the Latino vote. Courting the Latino vote is not a one-stop shop. It concerns to the Puerto Rican community that can vastly differ from the Venezuela community, Mexican, Colombian, and many others. so it does, it turns to the messaging that they will use to have a connection mm-hmm. with the Latino community.
Right.
And most of those messages are around issues.
Let's talk about the issues. You know, depending on where you sit in the state and your political persuasion, you're motivated by different issues. Latinos, I'm generalizing somewhat, but Latinos in South Florida often tend to be more conservative than groups in other parts of the state. Let's begin with South Florida. How do you see both the...
We had some technical difficulties there with Melissa's connection in Jacksonville, but I'll pick up kind of, I think, the thread of the thought here, Janice, which
turned
is
out
how do you...
in Doral, reaching out to the Venezuelan community there. So let's begin with what you're seeing. What are you hearing from voters in South Florida?
Well, voters are being in the primaries. Let's talk about primaries in particular. We see that among the Latinos, there is a vast collaboration in terms of mobilizing the Latino vote. And we have been able to see that this year, more than ever, over 1,500,000 Latinos requested vote by mail for primaries. And most of those counties were down in South Florida, Miami-Dade, Melbourne. So it is interesting that during the pandemic, we have seen more participation on the vote by mail, but that really doesn't define the overall engagement. We also seen in the Central Florida area that there is an increase in Latino voter turnout, but there are some counties in particular that are majority Latinos that really didn't reach out the numbers that we were expecting. So it is interesting because if we talk about the trends of this campaign for the elections, right, we have seen that in 2018, the participation of Latino increased to 13%, which it was a huge leap when we compare it to 2014 election compared to the 27%. But again, it's all about messaging. We need to make sure that this campaign, candidates and parties really reach out to the messaging of each one of those subgroups within the Latino community. So they can attend to the needs, expectations, and really the ask. I don't know if you want me to continue, but I will be more than happy to highlight how the COVID really has interacted with this election.
Janitzia, it's Tom Hudson. Let me ask you to play upon that. What are the messages that you're hearing? Clearly, the Hispanic Latino vote in Florida, not monolithic at all. It is very diverse, both in terms of background, economic, socioeconomic considerations and realities. So what are the messages that you're seeing, that your group, your nonpartisan group, Hispanic Federation, are experiencing when it comes to the outreach from the major top of the ticket, President Trump and former Vice President Biden particularly, as they're reaching into Florida and trying to attract those types of voters, Cuban Americans in South Florida, Puerto Ricans in Central Florida, Colombian Americans, Venezuelan Americans across the state? What are the changes? What are the complexities of those messages?
So there is issues around environmental concerns. And also for the Puerto Rican community in particular, the reaction and the betterment of the island. There is a lot of Puerto Ricans there. They came here after Hurricane Maria. And yes, they have settled here, but they still have families and relatives in the island are really being challenged every single day because for the neglect and less, you know, for better work, really not having the resources that the island needed in the prompt time to act upon. So there are different type of messaging, but also we need to see it on their perspective on the pandemic. The pandemic has created a health and economic crisis in the Latino community. We are also in the middle of the hurricane season in Florida, as you know. So we have been overwhelmingly seeing the Puerto Ricans and many other communities that has been settled here for 3 years ago, but still they're confronting the challenges, the economic and challenges. So there are a variety of messaging, but most of the messaging is around economic empowerment, whether it's job loss or better jobs or increasing salaries, also affordable housing, affordable mm-hmm. health care, and a more higher education.
So what is the challenge for the Trump campaign to reach this group and then correspondingly the Biden campaign? As Tom said, Biden is performing a little more poorly with Hispanic voters in Florida than he was. Kamala Harris landed in South Florida yesterday to reach out to the Venezuelan community there. Vice President Biden is coming to the state next week. President Trump is expected to make many visits to Florida in the next 6 weeks. If you were advising these campaigns, what would you be advising the president to say to Hispanics? And what would you be telling former VP Biden to campaign on with this voting bloc, which is 1 in 5 Florida residents?
Absolutely. Exactly. Those are the numbers. Well, first of all, candidates and the political parties can continue to talk about the Latino vote like a thing. The Latino vote bloc is made of individuals and family with real questions, with real expectation from the government, and issues that really matters to them. So I would suggest bring the Latino community to the table, listen what they're saying, listen what their expectation, what are the changes that we're looking as a community, and really having them as a part of the table. To have those conversations and not only have messaging around it, but pretty much develop the platform that serves for those necessities. I think that is what they need to do. Anyone who really pretends to do a campaign to to mobilize the Latino vote and that makes them voice part of that, it will miss the mark by far.
305-995-1800, our statewide phone number, talking about politics here in the final stretch of the 2020 campaign and the outreach that the top of the ticket is having for Hispanic voters in Florida. If you're undecided at this point, please join the conversation. Let us know what messages are resonating with you. What do you want to hear from the candidates to make up your mind? 305-995-1800. We're speaking with Janice Velez, Florida director with the Hispanic Federation, a nonpartisan group. Janice, let me ask you that President Trump and Republicans in Florida paint Joe Biden and Democrats as socialists and talk about socialism and socialism policies. Democrats, meantime, label President Trump as a caudillo, a term used to describe the Latin American dictators like Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro. How effective are these labels for voters?
I think voters are really fed up with this type of narrative. They're really looking transparency and looking to solutions for the issues that we are confronting daily on daily basis. I think that we cannot continue to manage the same type of strategy with to mobilize the Latino community as we did 10 or 20 years ago. We really need to pay the ear on the ground and really listen. What are the challenges?
So do you think those themes around, you know, socialism or Cadillo, those are harkening back to 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Is that what you're saying?
I think it really doesn't resonate with the younger generation, and it doesn't resonate with the community that are being coming from different countries. I think that what they're really want is to hear people that speak to their now.
We're talking about the importance of the Latino vote in Florida as the presidential campaign ramps up. 305-995-1800 to connect with the Florida Roundup. Tweets to at Florida Roundup. Here's a tweet from a listener. Any Latino in Florida who votes for Donald Trump and other Republicans is a fool. Trump does not care about you because you are not what he considers white. Trump is responsible for the deaths of over 3,600 Americans in Puerto Rico because they are not, and he uses the word white in quotes. Wake up, he says. All right, Yanitzi, what about the strong emotions, particularly among Puerto Ricans in Central Florida, over the way the administration responded to the widespread damage of the hurricane there, Hurricane Maria? Do you see this type of sentiment affecting some votes in this state or not? The president has about a quarter, 25% or so of the Latino vote in this state. What about that listener and his comments?
Well, those are the sentiments, and we need to look into why that person thinks like that. But I cannot really talk about, you know, whether Biden or Trump. Again, we are no partisan. But what I can say is that working with the community on the ground for so many years, and Hispanic Federation mobilizing the Latino community vote, and pretty much educating on the electoral process, so they can choose, pick whoever they want to vote, but really to know the facts, is that, yes, the Puerto Rican community has been hurt, not only here, the diaspora who has come from the island, but those who have stayed there and cannot vote for the president. These are going to be factors that are going to influence the votes of many Puerto Ricans in the state, and pretty much in those major states where there are Puerto Rican communities.
According to Pew Research, 1 in 5 Florida voters in this election cycle are Hispanic, and Hispanics are the fastest growing portion of Florida's electorate into the election. Many registered as independent voters, some of this driven by the Puerto Rican exodus that we saw after Hurricane Maria. 305-995-1800 in South Florida, Miramar. Andres on line 5. Go ahead, Andres. You're on the radio.
Good morning. Good afternoon, I should say. You know, this comment about Maria, definitely I'm voting for Mr. Biden. I would never vote for Mr. Trump. The way he treated Puerto Rico was disgraceful. But, you know, I could have put that aside, had this guy, President Trump, done something competent with the COVID-19 epidemic. I mean, this guy's conduct has been really outrageous. I mean, you know, they talk about this guy putting a mask. You know, at this point, this guy doesn't need to put a mask over his face. What he needs is a bag over his face. His conduct has been outrageous. It's been disgraceful. So my vote is definitely for Mr. Biden.
A clear, confident vote there, Andres. We appreciate you sharing your perspective there from Miramar in South Florida, 305-995-1800. Janitzi, I'm wondering about conventional wisdom and the Hispanic vote. Clearly not monolithic, as we've talked about here just in this conversation. We know that. But the conventional political wisdom nationally is that Hispanic voters lean Democratic. Melissa's tweet that she read, not from her, but from a listener, Andres from Miramar, we just heard, both of those in support of Vice President Biden's presidential bid. This idea of Hispanic voters leaning Democratic hasn't necessarily been the case in Florida. Why do you think this misconception persists on the national level, at least, as it relates to Florida?
Well, in 2018, 73% of the Latino voter in favor of Democrats.
Is that nationally?
In the state of Florida in particular, and nationally. And these helped 42 people of Latino oranges to be elected in the Congress. That set the record in 2018. Not only Latino, but we also see a lot of more females. I think that, yes, Latino have favored the Democratic Party in every presidential election since, I think, more or less, I think, around 1980. But, again, our Latino population has been growing in historical numbers. And the diverse, in terms of how they think, how they react to crisis, is different. We can never be sure. We can see the trends. We can see more or less the overall perception. But really, we can say that's why Florida is one of the biggest swing states, right? I think it's not about putting all together. We will never know until the very end. What we know is that there are estimated 30% of the Latino community that really voted for Donald Trump in 2018. And that is a higher rate than majority, no partisan voter registrants that really we don't know what way they're going to go. That is why it is important, this type of the electoral process, where people are being educated and informed, and more important, that they are being connecting with their own empathy in terms of issues. When the candidates start doing their primaries and they're doing their virtual events now during the COVID-19 because of the social distancing, we're going to see a more interest from the Latino community into really listen and pay attention to what their candidates are going to say. And if that is going to resonate with their sentiment, that's the question.
Let me just interrupt here because we're going to take a quick timeout, but I want you to hold the line. We're speaking with Janitzi Velez, Florida director with the Hispanic Federation, a nonpartisan group, taking more of your phone calls at 305-995-1800, talking about the Hispanic vote in Florida ahead of the 2020 election. It is just less than 2 months away.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami, talking about politics at 305-995-1800. Are you still undecided into the 2020 election? Tell us about that at 305-995-1800 or tweet at Florida Roundup.
As we continue the conversation with Janitzi Velez, Florida Director of the Hispanic Federation, let us know who will get your vote. Carlos is on the line in Kissimmee. Hey, Carlos, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Sure.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say that as a Latino immigrant into the United States, I'm ashamed by the way Donald Trump has been treating us. I live in a community and I do landscaping. I have been told many times as Mexican, even I am not Mexican, I am Colombian, by people that see us as a threat and people that see us as no good for the country. And I got to tell you that I have been a very successful person here thanks to my Democratic state of New York, where I was treated different than here. And I will stay in Florida, but I want to tell my Latino friends and community that we should vote for a candidate that is going to unite the country, because when Trump is gone, then what's going to happen?
Having a little trouble hearing the last... Oh, there you are. Go ahead.
I just saying that when Trump is gone, we're still going to be here, and we're going to have to heal this situation. Then, you know, the situation with Kobe and those tapes recently,
okay,
is just crazy.
Carlos, thank you for that. All right, Yanitzi Velez, we've heard from several callers and people engaging with us on Twitter at Florida Roundup. Latino voters across Florida expressing a lot of anger at President Trump, and saying that because of his sometimes racist rhetoric, his anti-immigration response in Puerto Rico, that Vice President Biden will be getting their vote. Now, that said, as you've pointed out, this isn't a monolithic voting bloc in the state of Florida. And so, you know, the election of could turn on this in Florida. This could be a decisive voting group, because this state is a swing state, as we know. And the polls that we've been seeing are a point or two between the two candidates. One poll even showed them to be tied exactly. And so we are going to be treated to both of these candidates spending a lot of time messaging to these voters across Florida over the next 60 days. When you hear this emotion coming over the phone lines, what are your reactions to that?
Experiencing some technical difficulties here. Let's see if our guest is still with us. Yanitzi Velez with the Hispanic Federation. Can you still hear us?
Okay, I guess we've lost her, but...
Sounds like we have, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's 305-995-1800 as we talk about the presidential election. We want to hear from you, Florida. Whether you are Latino or not, who will get your vote in November? You know, Tom, as we look at this, it's really been fascinating how the national media has laser focused on this very issue. Recent polling looking at this group of Florida voters and why they are so important to both campaigns. An NBC News Marist poll found a dead heat in Florida, both candidates at 48% of likely voters. And with Joe Biden underperforming slightly among Florida Latinos, as you said at the top of the hour, other polls show pretty much a tie between the two candidates. So, you know, when you look at the fact that Barack Obama won Florida in 2008 and 2012, Hillary Clinton lost it in 2016, Democratic strategists in particular are feeling a lot of anxiety about these statewide surveys in Florida. But it's a hard button to beat on, because as we were listening to in this discussion, this is a diverse population, and
sure,
there's going to be a lot of movement, I think, too. Some late deciders. This is a complicated picture for this state.
It's a complicated picture. It's a large picture, right? So one out of five registered voters, eligible voters in Florida, are Hispanic, and they have been registering at a higher clip than other groups. But as we've seen in elections, it really is the turnout that obviously is going to make the difference. We saw that in 2016 with the top of the ticket. We saw it in 2018 with the gubernatorial race and with the U.S. Senate race, particularly between Bill Nelson and former governor, now U.S. Senator Rick Scott. And Hispanic voter turnout mm-hmm. has been growing strong and more reliable. It was over 50% in 2018 in that off presidential election year. And we have seen an increase overall in, of course, vote by mail requests, and watching that Hispanic voter turnout and looking what that's going to be experiencing with vote by mail requests and early voting is a place certainly the candidates and the campaigns are going to be diving into that data in the final waning days and weeks of the campaign in the months ahead. I believe we have our guest back with us now. Janid C. Velez with the Hispanic Federation. Can you hear us again?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry about the technical difficulties. Talk to us a little bit about Hispanic voter turnout. We've seen it growing here, particularly in Florida. What's driving that? And also your federation's work and the work of the campaigns and parties about registering eligible voters. What has that been like over the past several months? And what kind of success or not have you experienced?
Absolutely. As you mentioned earlier, among the Latino voters' turnout, it has been more reliable, right, in recent years. And 40% of the registrants this year are not affiliated to any party. So going back to the initial statements, yes, the next months are their next 60 days are going to be crucial for the parties and the candidates to really connect with the Latino voters of Florida. And it's going to be very decisive, maybe the last couple days for the undecided voters. In both previous election, we have seen that the increase of the Latino voter turnout is there, and it has doubled since 2014. So in terms of how we compare this election to previous is that really we have a higher likely vote from Latinos who are registered but not have been reached out yet by the parties or the candidates. So we are hoping that now we're going to see more messaging. Now we're going to see more virtual events. Now we're going to see more emailing and phone banking. And part of the work that Hispanic Federation have done as a nonpartisan organization is that we started last year doing town hall, educating the community on the electoral process, how to register to vote, in terms not like to assist them in the process so they can understand it, mm-hmm. to update their voter information. And we have been able to do that even during the pandemic. We turn all our operation, not only here in the state of Florida, but everywhere we have in a regional office. The national, the headquarters, and all the effort for the civic engagement has been on really making the Latino vote intelligent voter that knows
what informing they're doing. And connecting the voters. And I want to thank you. Yes, thank you so much for connecting all of our listeners to your insights. She's Janice Velez, Florida Director of the Hispanic Federation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Dozens of people now face charges. They lied to get millions of dollars in loans that were designed to be used by companies to save jobs. One of those is NFL player Josh Bellamy. He plays for the New York Jets, lives in Florida. He's accused of getting over $1 million in Paycheck Protection Program loans for his company. Now, that money was supposed to be spent on keeping employees on payroll amid the pandemic, but federal prosecutors this week say that he spent thousands of dollars at Gucci and jewelers and at a South Florida casino. An investigation by the Miami Herald found dozens of questionable loans to Florida companies, more than any other state.
Right. Ben Weider has been looking into this. He's part of the Miami Herald McClatchy Washington Bureau I-team, and he's on the line. Hi, Ben. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And give us a call. Let us know your thoughts about the Paycheck Protection Program and abuses here in Florida. 305-995-1800. And we're getting your tweets about this, too. We'll get to those in a few minutes. So this is a really eye-popping investigation on your part. You found more than 75 questionable companies got paycheck protection loans around Florida of at least $150,000. What about these particular companies stood out and made them suspicious?
Yeah, so we were looking at companies that seemed to be newly created. The program was designed to prop up existing businesses that were struggling because of the pandemic, but not to be, you know, to provide funding for a new business. And so the rules of the program said you had to have been in existence as of February 15th, 2020. So we just looked at businesses that seemed to be created after April 1st. And then, you know, once we identified, and we identified hundreds of businesses like that, once we identified those businesses, we went through and checked each and every individual business to try to get a sense of, you know, whether there might be some explanation for why they appear to have registered later. And in many cases, we found out that there were, you know, sort of technical reasons that explained the filings we had found. But the businesses we focused on, these more than 75 businesses across the country, they all seemed to be new businesses, and many of them raised a number of red flags beyond the fact that they were new.
Right, and as we heard Tom mentioned, Josh Bellamy of the NFL certainly raised eyebrows for the way he spent his money. But what are some other examples that you found that just don't pass the smell test? What are some specific examples that stood out to investigators?
Yeah, so we found a few things that really struck us. We found a network of companies connected to a man in Texas that had identical websites for several of the businesses. And in one case, an online university connected to these guys that got a people of the information on its website from an unaffiliated university in Europe. I spoke to someone at the university in Europe who said, we've never heard of these guys. We have nothing to do with them. We also found lots of owners who had, you know, histories of bankruptcies. And in one case, a Florida woman who had actually served time in prison for fraud.
We're talking about paycheck protection loans in Florida and why some businesses with questionable credentials got the money while other businesses struggled to get that money. It's here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Scott Schwartz is with us now, chef owner of El Jefe Tex-Mex restaurant in Jacksonville. Scott and the restaurant received one of those Paycheck Protection Program loans several months ago. Scott, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
How much money were you able to get in that PPP loan?
We actually received a little over $158,000. And that was, you know, of course, calculated off of our payroll numbers that we sent in.
And how have you used that money?
Well, we received our loan on May 5th, and it was part of the second round. And, you know, there were very strict rules, you know, at that point where you had to use 80% of it payroll. You could use it for utilities and rent. And, you know, obviously everybody wanted forgiveness. And I was so scared not to get forgiveness that I actually ended up spending about 90% of it on payroll. You know, bringing back employees that I had, you know, laid off, and just really tried to follow the rules, which were very convoluted. We had no idea. We had a team of attorneys and accountants with me and all of my other restaurateur friends here in town, just trying to figure out what was, you know, permissible and what wasn't permissible.
Yeah. Some of that complexity, I know, has been highlighted in the Miami Herald investigation, which we'll talk more about in a moment with Ben. But we're speaking with Scott Schwartz, owner of El Jefe Tex-Mex restaurant in Jacksonville, wondering how many folks, who may have stayed employed because of a Paycheck Protection Program loan, or if you're a business owner, your experience with this program at 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. $1,800. Scott, do you have any of that $158,000 left?
Oh, no, because unfortunately, because we were in that second round and it was, you know, it was so early, all of the extensions hadn't taken place yet. So we were given an 8-week window, and, you know, we were employing, you know, fortunately, we were able to bring back a lot of employees that, at the time, you know, unemployment was a complete debacle here in the state of Florida. But we were able to bring them back because they had been going through the system and getting nowhere. We had a number of employees that wouldn't come back because, you know, their unemployment had kicked in and they were making more money, you know, on unemployment. But those that we were able to bring back, you know, we kept them busy, and we, by the time that they did the extension, we were already so far threw the money and we had employed all these people, the option was, do I then lay these people off again to conserve that money to go forward and stretch it out longer? And at that point, I just couldn't do it. I just said, well, we're on this path. You know, at the end of our 8 weeks, we'll have to see where the cards lie.
And so where did the cards fall?
Well, the cards, basically, it was what we had all predicted and expected, and I think was one of the impetuses for the extension, was at the end of the 8 weeks, we had to let people go again because, we had such a finite period. Now, fortunately, I was able to, pick up work feeding nurses and first responders, and that has certainly allowed me to keep a number of those employees still on the payroll, but it didn't last as long as I would have liked.
Scott, do you think this paycheck loan, which is under scrutiny for allegations of fraud here, do you think that loan in your case helped keep your business afloat?
Well, I mean, it certainly helped keep our business afloat, for a very short period of time. I will tell you that if it was not for, feeding the nurses, we would be in dire trouble.
Scott, hold on the line here. We got to take a quick timeout talking about the Paycheck Protection Program here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. It's 305-995-1800. Got questions about the Paycheck Protection Program and the new investigation showing dozens of loans went to questionable companies? Did you have trouble getting a PPP loan for your business? We want to hear from you. As we continue now with Ben Weider of the Miami Herald and the McClatchy Washington Bureau I-Team, and Scott Schwartz, he's the chef and owner of El Jefe Tex-Mex Restaurant in Jacksonville. Ben, here's a tweet from a listener. He says, could someone explain how after a failed M&A, Steinmart was able to secure millions in PPP loans, even though they were publicly traded and a company experiencing bankruptcy? Also, how did churches wind up getting PPP money, even though they pay no taxes? And what about the separation of church and state? And so, I think there is a lot of frustration out there or cynicism about how this money was handed out. What are your thoughts about how the public is perceiving this program and who's getting the money and who isn't?
Yeah, I think I think at the end of the day, that's the big concern about potentially fraudulent loans is that, we know from our reporting just how hard it was for so many businesses to get PPP loans. We spoke with businesses, early on in the pandemic who were struggling, much like Scott's business, and who were not able to actually successfully obtain PPP loans, and in some cases those businesses went under. And so it's that much more frustrating, I would imagine, for those business owners to see that some of the recipients who got this money might not have been, deserving recipients and might not have used it for the right reasons. That's really why this really matters at the end of the day.
Johnny is on the line in Tampa. Hi.
Apologies again, experiencing some technical difficulties with our connection
everyone,
to Melissa in Jacksonville. Ben, let me just have you kind of finish up this idea about the public perception and the reality of what your reporting has found.
Yeah, I think that, this is why fraud in the program matters, is that businesses needed this money. I mean, it's also taxpayer money, so it is our money that is being wasted in these cases. But also, deserving businesses that needed this money to stay afloat, like Scott's business, weren't successful and weren't able to get it. And what we found is that, in many cases, the people who did get this money don't appear to have necessarily, qualified for the rules. And, as we've seen in the criminal charges that have come out, in many cases, we're using this money for expenses that had nothing to do with the intentions of the program.
Right.
I hope you guys can hear me now. Do we have Johnny in Tampa on the line? Hi, Johnny. Are you there? Go ahead. Well, what he wanted to ask was that he felt that the bill was pushed through too fast, Ben, that the government rushed this whole rescue package through quickly to just get help to people who were struggling.
That's been, I mean, it's
still not, it's, uh, not, it's, uh, not
It's a good point, and I think that's one of the issues that people have raised, which is, you know, what fraud protections were potentially put in place at the beginning. And Scott alluded to the fact that the rules of the program changed over the course of the program as well. So in Scott's case, he had a very short period of time to use the money. Later on, businesses had a longer period of time so they could stretch it out longer. Because of this rush to get money out the door, there weren't necessarily as many fraud protections put in place on the front end as some fraud experts say they would have expected. So, you know, when I talked to former FBI agents, former federal prosecutors, they said when they saw this program rolled out, they were expecting to see fraud because there was pretty lax enforcement of fraud on the front end. Some say, you know, listen, that might be okay. There's a term called pay and catch that one FBI agent used, describing to me, which is that you pay this money out, and then you hope that the people who have obtained it fraudulently are going to go out and buy luxury cars or boats or, you know, spend it on things they shouldn't be spending it on, and then we're going to catch those people and bring the money back.
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of like a broken window theory of economic development, though. Break windows in order to replace them and put jobs in place, though. I don't think approving hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money for stimulus plans just in the hopes of catching some bad actors is necessarily the right way to make public policy. But Scott Schwartz, you went through this process of applying and successfully applying in the second round for the Paycheck Protection Program. What was your sense of fraud protection or detection as you walked through this process and provided the paperwork and the documentation that was requested of you?
I mean, it was a very simple process. We basically, you know, we were given a form, we filled it out. When it came time to exchange documents, you know, we sent in our, you know, tax forms, our payroll, you know, tax forms. So, I mean, it was very simple. I can see where things could fall through the cracks fairly easily because, again, it's not like applying for, let's say, a traditional SBA loan or a mortgage or anything like that, where they really dive deep into those financials, and it wasn't like that.
Yeah, it was a simple form, audited financials, and it was a lot of trust, but was it Verify on your behalf, Scott? Did you get a sense that in your case, that going through a bank, which is how these loans were handed out, were verifying the information?
Well, I mean, we went through Bank of America, which is who we bank with, and they asked for, you know, certain forms. We sent those forms in. What they did with the information that we gave them, how far, how deep they dove into it, I did not get a sense that it was a very deep dive. I think that at the time it was all about speed and just, you know, trying to, you know, money out to help. But, you know, there was a sense that it was to help the small business when really it was, you know, to help the employees, because by putting those tech constraints and those constraints on what the percentage had to be spent on, we have to look at it that the employees, yes, you know, we brought back employees, and that was a great stimulus. But if the restaurant doesn't survive past the 8 weeks, then, you know, we're not going to have a place to employ employees a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now.
Yeah, and then what? Scott, hold the line. Scott Schwartz is sure. Chef and owner of El Jefe Tex-Mex Restaurant in Jacksonville, who received a $158,000 forgivable loan as part of the Paycheck Protection Program. And Ben Weider is with us, part of the Miami Herald McClatchy Washington Bureau investigative team. Your phone calls at 305-995-1800. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Let's go to Jim in Orlando. He tried to get a PPP loan for his company. Hi, Jim. So what happened good to have you. What happened with your loan application?
Well, the huge hole in the plank that we fell through after my 23-year-old company is the major holder of the company cannot have filed bankruptcy. I filed bankruptcy in January after 10 years of paying stupid interest rates and working with banks that just wanted their money from 2008 when they devalued my credit. So now I shut down for 2 months like everybody else did and realized that wasn't going anywhere. So we brought the guys back, tried to just...
What's your company, like Jim?
It's called Cooperative Motor Works. We restore antique motorhomes.
And so you didn't get the loan then? Is that the upshot?
No.
You didn't get the loan?
No.
Okay. And I'm so sorry to hear that. And you doubt you'll get another one. I'm sorry, Jim. And that's Jim in Orlando.
It's a miracle we're still here, bro.
Well, I hope you can keep going, Jim. And I appreciate the call. Ben Weeder with the Herald and McClatchy. This is such a common story. A guy like Jim running a small business and is unable to get through all the hoops that were set up with this program. And so for guys like him, when they read your report and see how many people got the money that really didn't deserve it, I can only imagine the frustration they feel.
Yeah, and we've heard from businesses since we published the story that are frustrated, businesses that got it that are frustrated with the challenges that they're facing now. Soon, some businesses are starting to fill out their forms to ask for forgiveness, and that process is not an easy process. And obviously, people who are outraged to see some of the people who did get it. I mean, we've all seen really sad stories about businesses that were forced to shut down or that have really struggled as a result of missing out on it. And, the reality is that, there were people who were turned away who shouldn't have been turned away. Yeah. And obviously, as I think we found, there were people who were accepted who probably shouldn't have been accepted. And that's one of the challenges with the program. It's the challenge with moving very quickly as the program did. We'll see if down the road, if there are future rounds of this program, as has been discussed, if these experiences change the rules going forward, if they adapt to make things, a little bit easier and more accommodating to the businesses that need this help.
Ben, we have just less than a minute left here, but as we are seeing some prosecutions now, some allegations being made in court against some of these actors, what kind of clawback possibility is there for some of these loans that if they are found to be fraudulent?
So the feds have said that they will claw back the money. They will claw back money from the individuals, the businesses that got the money if they obtained them fraudulently, and from the banks that issued that approved the loans, which is significant because effectively that was probably one of the biggest disincentives for banks to just approve everything, which is you got paid a certain fee for approving each of these loans, and potentially you're on the hook if that loan winds up turning out to be fraudulent.
Yeah, fair enough. Ben Weeder, thanks for sharing your reporting with us. Appreciate it, sir.
Thank you.
Ben Weeder, Miami Herald, McClatchy, Washington Bureau investigative team, and Scott Schwartz, chef and owner of El Jefe Tex-Mex restaurant in Jacksonville. Scott, best of luck to you, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening to the Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zapka is the director of radio programming at WLRN. The director of radio ops is Peter Meritz. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Theme music from Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday at noon. Have a great weekend.